panelists will have our second speaker, Mr. Richard Bisjoesjan. All we know about him is that he is impeccably dressed and he always moves here around with an air of philosophical dignity. He holds a PhD from Notre Dame and has been an associate director of United States International Communication Agency. Bisjoesjan.
Thank you very much, Leopold. The topic I'm going to talk about today is culture and politics at home and abroad. I think I have credentials to address both sides of these because I had an opportunity to make an in-depth assessment of two of our United States government's agencies, the National Endowment for the Humanities and the United States International Communication Agency Directorate for Educational and Cultural Affairs. In both instances, my service was limited in time, and thus my efforts at comprehending what these agencies do in the name of culture was necessarily concentrated. As team leader of the National Endowment for the Humanities Transition Team, my colleagues and I had about 2 months to evaluate how that agency then spent $150 million a year, and as associate director designate for educational and cultural affairs at USICA, I had roughly 4.5 months to evaluate ECA that spends about $100 million a year in the name of culture. I can only say that I'm grateful I didn't have an opportunity to work at the National Endowment for the Arts. The National Endowment for the Humanities came into existence during the Johnson administration in 1965, and the USICA's Directorate for Educational and Cultural Affairs is a descendant of the State Department's Bureau of Cultural Affairs that originated in May 1938. Both agencies provide an interesting commentary on the role of culture in democratic society, the relationship between culture and government, and the need for substantial rethinking on this topic. But before giving you the benefit of my experience, brief though it was, let me simply say what I mean by culture. In the limited sense in which I want to use that word, I refer to the reality of national culture and not the unreality of worldwide transnational culture. And so far as the United States government has any business involving itself in cultural affairs, it ought only to be as a mediator through which American national culture can be represented abroad. As national culture, culture refers to the consciousness of the American people of what we are as a community. That encompasses the truths that we share, the traditions, political and social traditions, that constitute our historical memory of ourselves as a people. That encompasses also our political experience, our religious experience, including our commitment to a higher law and concepts of justice rooted in the Old and New Testament. Culture, therefore, as I use it and as it is intimately associated with, indeed derives inspiration from, the political. It necessarily is political. It is public because it deals with that which all citizens of the realm have in common. Of course, culture also includes sports and the arts, music, sculpture, theater, literature, dance, all that is usually associated with culture. But culture is not necessarily nor exclusively artistic and educational. Culture is representative of man's search for truth. Even in a pluralistic society such as ours, we are reminded frequently that we hold these truths. Ontologically, culture is a manifestation of man's consciousness of reality. In the form of cultural, legal, and intellectual artifacts, a society or realm over time records and documents the development of its own unique interpretation of the reality that all mankind experiences. But it puts its unique national stamp on that common experience. And so in that way, a nation contributes to its common consciousness, its unique consciousness of its existence in history. That is culture. This concept of culture conflicts with the notion that has, for the most part, been accepted as the basis of our cultural diplomacy. All of you are aware of the long millennial tradition that has been a part of American culture. Ernest Lee Tubison's Redeemer Nation, for example, shows the development of the Puritan expectation that America is God's new Israel into the secular millennialism of Woodrow Wilson that America is leading the world into a new era of peace and democracy. An important new study of the United States foreign policy and cultural relations between 1938 and 1950 by Frank Ninkovich of St. John's University in New York titled The Diplomacy of Ideas, updates this history and focuses on its cultural aspects. Ninkovich's history reveals the tension that existed and still exists today in the State Department and now the United States International Communication Agency between those pragmatic fashioners of foreign policy on the one hand and those largely in the Bureau of Cultural Affairs who sought to fashion a policy of cultural diplomacy that transcended America's foreign policy goals. These latter cultural policymakers were characterized by a disgust for power politics and were guided by a desire to foster the development of an international democratic culture. They were convinced that the spread of rationality, knowledge, and understanding provided the basis for a liberal ecumenical world community. Culture, in essence, for these cultural diplomats, was really universal, not national. They believed, therefore, that a true policy of cultural diplomacy rested on the transcultural capacity of ideas to hasten the arrival of a generalized, worldwide, liberal understanding. Ninkovich writes that these advocates of international understanding were actually calling for the elimination of culture altogether, for ultimately, their belief in the universality of ideas was not cultural at all, but supercultural, unquote. Quote, what passed for universalism, he writes, was only a projection of America's self-image and a distorted one at that, unquote. Ninkovich is saying that culture in its historical setting was actually seen by our cultural diplomats as an impediment to a pre-established harmony of human reason and social processes that would lead mankind into a new democratic international order, if only cultural diplomacy would not be impeded by American national culture and considerations. The problem, of course, is that the ideal of culture, unsullied by national experience, is false, and the American taxpayer wants something more for his dollar than liberal idealism that fails to advocate America's national interest, particularly in the present international climate. The present international climate is one of enormous danger to the United States and its allies. This is due primarily to the fact that the strategic advantage the United States once maintained over the Soviet Union in nuclear missiles no longer exists. The so-called window of vulnerability in which our ICBMs become vulnerable to increasingly accurate and powerful Soviet missiles has opened and seems not capable of being closed in any reasonably short period of time. All three basing modes considered for our MX missiles have serious deficiencies that make each technically risky. As a result, a decision on deployment as well as production of the MX has been deferred, and the strategic nuclear umbrella that previously protected ourselves and our allies is dangerously impaired. Our allies know this and have already developed policies that are more attentive, if not responsive, to the interests of the Soviet Union. At this moment, for example, the West German government of Helmut Schmidt is putting pressure on Italy to withdraw its offer to accept deployment of Pershing II and cruise missiles. EEC economic sanctions against the United States, against the Soviet Union for its actions against Poland, affected only 1% of common market USSR trade. The Papandreou government of Greece is acting as if it were the vanguard of an international liberation movement. European enthusiasm for the construction of a Soviet gas pipeline seems universal, and France is selling arms to communist-backed Nicaragua. The United States, moreover, did not provide the leadership required and failed to declare Poland in default. Sensing that its adversary, the United States, is vulnerable as never before, the Soviet Union has launched a massive propaganda effort by investing approximately $3.3 billion a year in anti-American information programs. I won't bore you with the summary of the main themes of this Soviet propaganda offensive. If you read the New York Times, Washington Post, or watch the network news reports of international events, you know quite well what the present Communist Party line is in regard to the United States. Unfortunately, the response of the United States is also well known. Like a blinded giant, the United States stumbles throughout the world in the main reacting to Soviet charges. Even though substantial amounts of money are spent by the United States government to counteract Soviet propaganda, these amounts expended by the United States for public diplomacy are insufficient to the task, and more importantly, they are poorly administered. Bill Buckley said it best in his syndicated column of February 26th, and I quote, "Ours has been a doctrine of coming up with a counter-salient. The Russians blockade Berlin, we mount an air supply operation. They strike in Korea, we defend Korea. They press in North Vietnam, we press back in South Vietnam. They now reintroduce bacterial weapons, we call for reintroducing them. We appear to be incapable of acting decisively on distinctive Soviet weaknesses. These are, of course, economic and spiritual. That is, the weaknesses of the Soviet Union are economic and spiritual. In the field of cultural diplomacy, of course, the United States government cannot do anything about announcing a grain embargo, but public diplomacy can address the spiritual weaknesses of the Soviet regime. Unfortunately, the requisite skills are not common assets. They require a knowledge and belief in the strength of American national culture, an understanding of the nature of totalitarianism, and a willingness to create programs that probe the spiritual weaknesses of the Soviet Union. Why is this not something that the United States government is doing? In part, it can be explained by the fact that our cultural diplomacy has been and is dominated by career Foreign Service officers, our permanent government. A career Foreign Service is an interesting phenomenon made up of bureaucratic administrators. The bureaucratic administrative function predominates, and the necessary political or public ingredient is given short shrift. This is not to be unexpected. America's permanent Foreign Service is constitutionally incapable of thinking politically. To think politically requires philosophical knowledge of what the political community stands for, knowledge of what substantive goods hold the community together. This in turn requires a capacity to know and to advocate the common life that gives our country its reason and being. For the Foreign Service officer, this is risky territory. To appear too anti-Soviet, for example, could jeopardize his career during periods of détente. As a result, the career man takes refuge in neutral roles and neutral positions. Clearly, the times require more forceful policies and more forceful managers of these policies. The Foreign Service is not equipped for this function and thus must be rigorously directed by the political appointees. All the same, one cannot place all the blame on those who seek careers in the Foreign Service or blame those who, in whom oversight has been entrusted. There is a deeper intellectual, yes, even a spiritual illness that afflicts our cultural diplomacy that ought to be discussed. I alluded to that illness when I distinguished the meaning of culture, as I've used it today, from culture in the sense of transnational culture, which I said was not reality-oriented. Let me explain. The core of the appeal of Marxism-Leninism, as well as the appeal of numerous other modern ideologies, including liberalism, is their view of history. Perhaps Nietzsche said it best when he observed that not the soul is the depth of man, but rather the future. And the depth of the soul, we learn from Anaximander in the Greek philosophical tradition, that we participate in divine reality. The spiritual stability, the common sense of our fellow Americans, is derived from this source, now mediated through Judaism and Christianity. We seek our peace in God, and in communion with Him, we derive our ability to endure in a spiritually arid world. The modern world is spiritually arid. Despite the bounteous physical comforts we enjoy, our industrialized society is not in conformity with patterns of life that gave stability to earlier periods. The fall harvest, planting in spring, the change of seasons, and the change of daily routine adjusted to those changes, the expectation that life would not change in our lifetime, the precariousness of life, lent stability to life in ways that Americans today can only imagine. But our lives are also arid because of the secularization of our culture. We don't live in a world full of gods or angels. We live in a world that is explained in scientific terms, in a world that in the name of science rejects the faith that sustained our forefathers. Our depth is not to be found in the soul, but in our expectation for the future. History, understood as the expectation that in time the ills that afflicted our predecessors and ourselves can be overcome, is our religion. Marxism-Leninism is similarly grounded. Communism is the riddle of history solved, Marx said. By that he meant that the end of history was known to Marx and to the party that would intervene in history to bring history to its conclusion. Our cultural diplomacy, since its inception, has been afflicted by a similar ideological disease. The cultural diplomacy of the United States has been founded on the illusory belief that greater understanding on liberal internationalist grounds will lead inevitably to world peace. In seeking such understanding, however, representation abroad of the uniqueness of American culture was rejected even to the extent that our cultural program sought, in effect, to avoid the advocacy of uniquely American aspects of national culture. The actual goal of our cultural policy abroad was and is the elimination of national culture in the name of a future international culture. Only those rationalistic, universalist aspects of American culture that were acceptable to liberal ideology found their way through the bureaucratic pipeline of American cultural diplomacy. Our cultural diplomacy, I believe, will always be ineffective until this intellectual disease is treated. I'm hopeful that this disease can be treated, but I don't underestimate the obstacles facing anyone who attempts its treatment. The bureaucracy of the Educational and Cultural Affairs Directorate at the United States International Communication Agency is still the haven of liberal ideologues of the variety discussed by Dr. Ninkovich. Without their replacement or an absolute commitment from the director of that agency to treat the disorder, nothing can be done. But more importantly, you have to know what has to be done. You have to have a consciousness and understanding of the depth of the problem. And unless that's fully understood, nothing will ever be done. This brings to mind the observation once made to me by a State Department official who must remain nameless. He observed, he now works in the White House, he observed that it may be difficult to reorient our cultural diplomacy because USICA is a second-level agency that cannot possibly attract either the career or the political talent needed to do the job unless it is returned to the State Department. By that he meant that the Educational and Cultural Directorate ought to be returned to the State Department from whence it was plucked by the Carter administration when it reorganized the United States Information Agency in 1978. This is, of course, only a procedural remedy, not the remedy that will do the job, and certainly I'm not in any way implying that the activities of the old USIA that were nobly served by such persons as Frank Shakespeare and his appointees are touched by this observation at all. Let me turn then to the topic of culture and politics at home. I've always enjoyed the following passage from de Tocqueville's Democracy in America, where in effect he says if you hold it expedient to divert the moral and intellectual activity of man to the production of comfort and the promotion of general well-being, and if you're content to meet with fewer noble deeds, provided offenses be diminished in the same proportion. If you're content not to live in the midst of a brilliant society, but contented to have prosperity around you, then establish democratic institutions. Tocqueville was observing the tension that exists in any democratic society between the tendency for the lowest common denominator to prevail and the excellence that must prevail, though that excellence is necessarily the capacity of the few. Martin Diamond aptly pointed out that the drafters of the Constitution provided a corrective for this weakness of democracies, that the process of indirect election and appointment, the size and variety of electoral districts, and the extensive power and prestige of national office that they believed would detract men of the highest attainment, wisdom, and virtue. A federal agency dedicated to the propagation and development of the humanities, therefore, ought to recognize that its special function involves a commitment to excellence. My colleagues on the National Endowment for the Humanities transition team and I found instead an agency that clearly had neither a true conception of excellence nor of the humanities. The principle that prevailed was simply this: if it moved, it was human, it ought to be funded. There were, of course, the big budget items that assisted the larger public to appreciate American and foreign cultures, projects such as Mark Twain on the Mississippi, the Adams Chronicles, and the King Tut exhibit. But for the most part, we found at the National Endowment for the Humanities an attempt to subsume the humanities endowment to greater, needless to say, politically liberal social projects that had as their intention to politicize the humanities with projects in mind that were sympathetic to Carter administration policy goals. Let me give you a couple of examples. A grant for a project titled The Contribution of the Gay Experience to American Visual Arts. $753,000 for a film dramatizing the life of textile workers in Roanoke Rapids, North Carolina, population 600. $79,000 to a woman at the University of Pennsylvania to expand course offerings on women in the undergraduate curriculum. $7,000 to the Illinois Labor History Society to do an oral and documentary history of Pullman porters. $49,000 to Indiana University to support programs in the humanities at the Indiana Department of Correction. $145,000 to the Maryland State Department of Education to support a critical and creative dialogue on the American prison and to increase the use of the humanities collection in the Maryland Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services. Though I have reason to believe that no one of any significance at the White House ever read the report of the National Endowment for the Humanities Transition Team, it was clear from the start that David Stockman was going to do something or anything that he could to substantially pare down the fiscal year 80 and 81 budgets of the National Endowment for the Humanities and National Endowment for the Arts. Indeed, when his cuts were announced, it showed that he had used the razor blade cutting away 50% of the previous budget. Immediately, all hell broke loose. Congressman Richmond, a great humanist, Congressman Yates, Senators Stafford and Pell, Stillburn Pell, they call him, and others in Congress, as well as museum directors, university presidents, and countless others, condemned the administration's actions. Though the cuts ultimately allowed by Congress were about 20% from previous levels, a healthy debate ensued about the role of government in funding the arts and the humanities. I hope that debate is not over and that further cuts are administered to these budgets, if only to engender more discussion. Much of the criticism brought against the Reagan administration, unfortunately, was beyond contempt. The Reagan administration was characterized as a crowd of uneducated yahoos depriving American communities of their cultural heritage. Sometimes this criticism was aroused by employees within the humanities and arts endowments themselves who lobbied their various constituencies with scare stories that omitted the simple axiom that what the president proposes is one thing and what the Congress disposes is another. All the same, there is something awry in the very process that presently determines how much is to be spent for the arts and the humanities and where it is to be spent. It is not politically palatable, for example, to tell Ames, Iowa, or Pierre, South Dakota, that it cannot have a federally funded ballet company. On the other hand, the question of whether there is enough ballet talent or any other refined artistic talent in the country to assure that Ames and Pierre have their own artistic events and companies is yet to be asked. The nature of the professional humanities and the arts is such that they are always found in their highest form in urban areas. The provinces will always have a provincial cast that cannot possibly attract the type of talent that naturally gravitates to urban centers. But by the same token, culture cannot be bought. Poland sustains its poets in ways that the United States does not and cannot. If government tries to circumvent the processes of cultural development that may take thousands of years, it will fail. Government has neither the ability, the intelligence, nor the responsibility to choose whom to reward and whom not to reward for humanistic achievement. Various lectureships, annual awards, freedom medals, or whatever monetary or symbolic means at government's disposal to honor achievement in the humanities and the arts will necessarily fail to raise the level of national culture. Only one honor bestowed by government that I can recall really means anything, the Congressional Medal of Honor, and that requires severe and immediate personal sacrifice. Thank you.